This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1. Hey, Bob, how's it going?
I think it's so groovy now that people are finally getting together. Well, not really, but there was a State of the Union this week, Connie.
And, great, yeah.
It's a big topic.
I heard it was a big party.
Well, I wasn't there. Once again, I was not invited.
Oh.
I don't represent any needed symbolic group for a photo op. But the thing that I think listeners should consider is that Barack Obama pledged to freeze domestic spending, but not military spending.
Oh, yeah.
So in my mind, if the military budget is $700 billion, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, wanted to cut $100 million or so, and Barack Obama is pledging to freeze domestic spending in the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. What does that mean?
It means the fiscal conservatives must be really upset that he's continuing to spend all this money on war.
And sadly, the people talking about cutting the defense budget, the Tea Party, the people on the right.
Really? The actual fiscal conservatives? Wow, I'm shocked.
There's libertarian trends within the Tea Party.
Wow.
But Barack Obama, who's positioning himself as a centrist to run, you know, for president for re-election in 2012, essentially, is allowing this ever-expanding imperialist massive military budget while holding domestic spending even.
Yeah, it's I'd say one of the great tragedies of America in a way, because, you know, while we're using our wealth to go dominate other countries and colonize and be imperialist, we're also not taking care of our own. You know, we're dominating and colonizing black communities here. It's basically the actions that we're taking around the world are so expensive that we're not able to provide for basic needs for our own brothers and sisters.
Yeah, the foreclosure crisis is continuing. We've got the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, record bankruptcies, record foreclosures, and another topic close to both our hearts, what appears to be a runaway shooting spree by police against black youth, with many being shot multiple times or shot in the bank. And at the same time, what the mainstream media, the mainstream for-profit media, is concerned with is police under siege. But here in Columbus, Ohio, shootings at Mount Vernon, shootings on the east side, the previous shooting of Dante Miller, and in many of these cases, people being shot. I talked to an eyewitness who saw a kid shot 8 times.
Wow.
And prior to that, Cliff Arnebeck, an attorney we've had on this show, who we work with on occasion, is representing somebody who was shot 7 times with a .44 Magnum.
Right.
Really a hand cannon, not a handgun.
Well, and are these people dangerous, foaming at the mouth criminals, or are they youth? It seems like a lot of these people are actually kids who are being shot.
Right. In the one case of the 16-year-old, he had a gun, you know, he had a weapon with him, carrying an illegal weapon, threw it away.
Mm-hmm.
And the reports, you know, from what happened is he's then shot with a .44 Magnum, knocked to the ground. And then his testimonies and others is that the cop looked down at him and said, "How old are you, son?" And he said, 16. And the cop then kind of said, "Oh, shit," and then shot him 6 more times.
Damn.
So at what point? I mean, it's a question of a standard, right? Tennessee versus Gardner. The police have a right, you know, to protect themselves when they're in fear for their lives, grave bodily harm. But when you shoot somebody and they're on the ground, you've already shot them, and then you empty your gun into them.
Right.
At what point?
It seems like they're trying to murder the person so they can't testify and point the finger.
Precisely.
Or say what happened. If you silence somebody permanently, they'll never be able to testify. And, I mean, that's just absolutely wrong, obviously. But I don't think people really understand the full extent of that injustice, because it's not just one incident where a police officer or a person is trying to silence another person. It seems to be a systematic problem that is pervasive in our American society, but, you know, very evident in Columbus locally.
Yeah, and Dante Miller, in this case Dante Miller, who was shot a few years back, the paper, if you analyze the media's coverage of this stuff, it's quite interesting. They'll say he was a wanted felon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they won't say what he was wanted for. He was a small-time drug dealer who had never been violent. You know, he sold a small amount of drugs. And, you know, those are illegal drugs. So he didn't show up in court. So he was wanted on felony drug sales, not for a violent crime.
Right.
And there was a warrant out for him. So you could say he was wanted, outstanding, you know, felon on felony charges, but it's not violent.
Right.
So when they show up to pick him up and he runs, he isn't a violent felon.
Yeah.
And they shoot him in the back. And then the police somehow find a gun. And there's always the question of the long tradition of the drop gun, because the police are always finding these guns when witnesses, in Dante Miller's case, who was shot in the back and killed, is white construction workers nearby, all report they didn't see a gun. They didn't see him throwing a gun. And these people are always running. They're not like turning around and attempting to shoot the cops. They're running away. And in the case where the guy was shot 8 times just recently on Martin Luther King Day, he was running towards a house where he knew somebody, and none of the witnesses say that he turned or indicated in any way that he had a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, it seems like the media coverage that you mentioned it seems to demonstrate how people really have kind of a black and white idea of what's going on, right and wrong, you know, that if somebody was a wanted felon, they hear that and it immediately triggers something like this idea that they get whatever's coming to them. But, I mean, it seems like, you know, there are a lot of, you know, there are programs for safe surrender to allow people to turn themselves in, that make it a little bit easier for offenders to turn themselves in. I think that, you know, that kind of demonstrates that it's not really, you know, such a black and white issue. I guess no pun intended on that, but maybe it is a little bit
and
a black
and
white issue.
A very clear Tennessee versus Gardner, the Supreme Court decision from back in the 70s, is that you can't shoot a fleeing felon just because he's or she is a felon.
Right.
Because there's degrees of felonies.
Right.
There's a, you know, tax evasion is a felony.
Yeah.
What Bernie Madoff did is a felony.
Right.
They're felons. If they don't turn themselves in, do you shoot them when you see them because they're fleeing felons?
Well,
unfortunately, you never hear what you never hear. Yeah, unfortunately, they don't shoot.
Unfortunately,
the white collar criminals.
It depends on the color of your skin, I think.
Yeah, and you never hear any white collar fugitives being shot,
hunted down,
felons
hunted down like some kind of like by bounty hunters, basically.
So people really need to pay careful attention to what the media is saying. And are the police really under siege?
Or are they bounty hunters?
Right, exactly. Or are people, you know, shooting back because they fear the police? Here's the other thing. There's a whole lot of people that lawfully have guns and concealed weapons on them.
Right.
How do you know whether or not somebody in Ohio you're shooting has a concealed, weapons permit?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's question. A lot of this came out in the 1960s, right, with the Black Panthers. You know, the right to bear arms,
yeah,
the right to observe what they believed was police injustices against the black community. In many ways, it seems like it's almost worse than it was then, because there was a sense of knowledge and identity and community among people in the black community and in the Native American community and in the peace movement,
yeah,
and in the college students, where they would stand up for their rights. These shootings seem to go on, and there's very little outrage, not only in the white community, but even in the black society itself.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that this has gone on for so long, even, you know, after some of those struggles and successes of the 70s and the movements then, you know, that people have kind of gotten used to it or expect it. And I mean, it seems like people definitely expect it. That's why they're running from the police in the first place, because they expect violence. They expect lynchings. They expect to be hunted and to be controlled in that way. I think that, you know, it's pretty disturbing. I mean, I don't know. I would like to find out what the zip codes of Columbus police officers are. If they are coming from outside of black communities to police black communities, if, you know, how far are they coming? You know, are they coming from rural communities to come police the inner city? And, you know, it brings up some very uncomfortable issues with white supremacy.
Well, it's really, I mean, there's been studies done. When I wrote for the Columbus Guardian, the paper at the time, did do a study,
okay,
looking at zip codes. And I always remember the name of the article. I didn't write it, but I did remember looking at all the research. It was simply called Army of Occupation.
Yeah.
And many, many of the police, a significant number, lived in rural counties. They didn't even live in Franklin County.
Right, okay.
Right? They were living in Licking County, and they're living in areas, Delaware County, Pickaway, in the rural areas.
And were they predominantly white?
Overwhelmingly so.
Okay.
And so, essentially, there's no community policing these people,
right,
in many ways. When Barry Etney was my
yeah,
client, and he was arrested for criminal trespass because he complained about police behavior. And then he's arrested twice in a short period of time.
He was in his own neighborhood, I think, wasn't he?
Right, yeah, he was, right in the Mount Vernon area. But it was interesting because he had a right. He was barred from going on a plaza because of the police lobbying to keep him off Mount Vernon Plaza because he was complaining about police brutality.
Right.
So the people who owned the plaza barred him. But he had a mailbox, and as a business owner, he was entitled to go to his federal mailbox in his neighborhood. So they said, fine, you go to the mailbox at the U.S. Post Office there, which was in a storefront. You just can't go to any of the stores. And when he was walking there, he was given a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, but I'm going to the post office. And the white sergeant who gave him the ticket said, there's no post office here. It would be a freestanding building. So this is the white police officer in the black neighborhood who doesn't know there's a post office
in the
at Mount Vernon Plaza.
Yeah.
What if there had been a shooting there?
Yeah.
What if there had been an incident there?
I actually go to that post office. It's kind of in a strip mall. And
it's
connected to... I mean, and I've seen other post offices in strip malls. I think there's one on Kenny Road, maybe there's the BMV there, but I mean, there
are
post
offices. But this is the sergeant
offices
in charge, yeah, of policing the area.
Yeah.
He doesn't know
he's
where the
familiar
post office is,
right,
in the area, and he comes to Barry's business across from the plaza after Barry complains about the police, and he says, you know, well, we've seen you at the plaza. And so instead of taking a complaint on police brutality and a shooting of a man running away, he instead issues a criminal trespass charge against the guy complaining, Barry,
mm-hmm,
Etney.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it based on false information and not having knowledge of the neighborhood he's supposed to police.
Right. And I think another problem in not having community policing, or rather having police officers not from the community come inside and virtually colonize, is that there can be a lot of cultural misunderstandings. If there's a certain demographic of people who live in a certain area, you know, it may be really useful to have somebody who's connected in that community to kind of, you know, tell people to settle down if they need to, or to help work things out among neighbors and prevent crime that way.
You want to win the trust of the community activists and community leaders instead of arresting them when they stand up for their community. Here's the problem, is you can never, as an outside occupying force of white police, the problem is it goes from being anybody could be a criminal, because I don't know the neighborhood, to everyone is a criminal.
Yeah.
So they're profiling black people.
Yeah, it's a cultural misunderstanding.
They're arresting them. And many of these
really
black people,
bad one.
You know, over on the Near East Side where I live, you end up seeing black business people on a traffic violation on their knees with a gun to their head, or being, you know, detained, spread eagle, because the police don't know the criminals from the people that actually live in the neighborhood.
Right.
And then they can't police the neighborhood because no one trusts them. No one is going to call the cops
on the
small group of real thugs
because
the police are seen as equal or worse thugs and more of a threat to you than the actual gang members in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, how are you supposed to be effective if you can't you know, really tell the difference? If you see someone who's African American or who has dark skin and you think everybody with dark skin is a criminal, it's just not going to work. And it's not plausible, and it's not true either.
So we need real community policing. We need neighborhoods to be responsible for conduct and their behavior. And that's not going to come from an occupying outside army with no respect for the people who live in those communities.
Well said, Bob. This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1. And coming up on March 18th to March 20th is the Left Forum at Pace University. What do you know about that, Bob?
Well, I've actually got a panel that's been accepted there with Mark Crispin Miller, one of the country's leading academic experts on the media. Mark Crispin Miller has written many books, but he's presenting a paper there on a panel that I'm on, dealing with how real problems, real tangible problems, CIA tied to drug running and the Golden Crescent, Air America, covert operations all over the world involving guns and drugs, is the way they deal with it, the way the mainstream for-profit media deals with it, simply denounces people as conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
I mean, this assumption that, number one, there's no conspiracies that really exist in the world.
Well, I have a response to that.
part of it, you know, in that if you say that this looks like some illegal activity by our government to have people arrested, detained, denial of rights, it looks like they're targeting free speech activists and preemptively arresting them, then they simply say, conspiracy theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's supposed to end the debate.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the media should be following up on the facts, not listening to the security industrial complex of the government, which is operating in secret and we know has been responsible for torture. We know has targeted activists and peace advocates and community groups in the past. But instead, all you got to do is call somebody a conspiracy theorist.
That's all it takes to discredit them. Well, I mean, on the topic of conspiracy theory, I'd like to point out that, you know, when I was in my criminal law class in law school, conspiracy is a theory under the law. It's in the criminal law that, you know, when two or more people get together and they have an agreement and,
do something illegal and they take an action towards that. For example, right now in your hand, well, not this isn't true, this is hypothetically, right now in your hand, if you if you had marijuana and
it's
you
just
said,
a pen, ladies and gentlemen. Yes,
it is a pen, it's even blue. And you said, I want to sell you this marijuana, and I said, yeah, I don't have money on me. Let me go to the ATM. Mm-hmm. We have just committed
a conspiracy.
A conspiracy.
Right? Because you've taken a step in furtherance of that conspiracy, going to the ATM machine. Right?
Right. A criminal activity. We have conspired, have we not? There's been a meeting of the minds.
An agreement to do something,
illegal. Yeah. Right?
And so, I mean.
And the criminal conspiracy, conspiracies are like common colds.
Yeah.
Every single day. I bet you right now, up at the Ohio State University, somebody is selling somebody pot or conspiring. Somebody saying, can you get me a quarter ounce?
Do you know somebody?
Right. You know? That is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
So, like, to pretend that, you know, it's sort of like saying that, okay, killing Caesar wasn't a conspiracy. There just happened to be three simultaneous stabbers show up at the same time. Conspiracies.
Yeah.
People plan to rob, more than one person plan to rob ATMs, plan to rob bakeries, plan to rob other things, plan to burglarize houses. Criminal conspiracies abound.
Yeah. It happens all the time.
And think of the mortgage companies.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So I guess, what do you think is the difference between those common conspiracies and what the media is alleging? Are they just basically, it sounds like they're basically just calling people who, you know, are trying to put the puzzle together on this corruption, they're basically just calling them wing nuts, as far as I can tell.
Right, it becomes a term that if I attach it to you,
it
you're supposed
me.
To be mocked and laughed at, and it discredits you.
Right.
So, and it's become a mantra.
Yeah.
For example, if I said, and I have said it, that it was no accident they failed to put out 42 voting machines, and all of them were in the inner city in black wards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the machines were not missing in 2004 in white suburbia. The 42 missing machines were from the black inner-city Democratic wards. Somebody who blacked out those machines was conspiring or working with somebody to suppress the black votes.
Right.
So they'll say, oh, that's just a conspiracy.
Yeah, so I'm the mainstream media, and when I hear that, as soon as I say, that's, this guy, Bob Fetrakis, is alleging conspiracy, what a wingnut. He must be, you know, it's a way to just... To even point out
and,
that someone's alleging
arguing,
a conspiracy tries to discredit
them. And the opposite of this is that it just happens to be a coincidence. 42 machines are missing. They just happen to be in the heaviest black wards with the highest voter turnout for the Democratic Party.
Right.
Right. They're not randomly distributed, you know, but they're all in the heavy black wards.
Yeah.
Or if I say the city of Cleveland purged 24.92% of all the voters, is that the voters were all concentrated in Cleveland, and more than one person participated in those purges. It's probably some sort of collusion, and these people are working for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's a conspiracy. Of course it is.
Well,
Republican officials conspired to suppress black vote.
Well, I think another reason that that charge of conspiracy theorists can discredit people is really, it seems like the people alleging this have a really lack of understanding of some of the historical underpinnings that, you know, cause people to act in racist ways and actually causes people to conspire to suppress the vote.
Sure, because there's a lot of white conservatives that don't feel uneducated, lower-class black people should vote. And throughout the entire history of the United States, up to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, from 1776 to 1965, they in fact targeted black people throughout the United States, throughout the Deep South, and stopped them from voting, lynched them, beat them, invoked the literacy test, invoked the grandfather clause, invoked the poll tax, burnt their churches, and harassed them so they wouldn't vote.
And it
seems that was a conspiracy.
And it seems like a lot of the justification for that has been anti-democratic, you know, ideas that, you know, people cannot govern themselves, that, you know, the freed slaves or, you know, African Americans coming up who are, you know, deprived of education, you know, that they were not qualified somehow to make decisions about, you know, voting decisions about, you know, what was going to happen in politics in their life.
But, I've had some of my students to this day saying people should be literate to vote. Some people are too stupid, too ignorant.
But maybe if
too
you never
if
you never get to vote and use the power that you have, that you're guaranteed with democracy, if you never have that, how are you ever going to secure the right to a proper education for your community? I think that's been a great problem, is that still African Americans in Columbus have not secured the right to have a proper and equal education with white children. That's a big problem.
But even on the most basic level, if you're black and your choices are Barack Obama, a mixed race African American running on a more liberal program, or John McCain, who's talking about endless war in Afghanistan, you're smart enough to determine that your interests are best served by not voting for John McCain and voting for Barack Obama. How much does it really basically take, right? If you're a, you know, 19-year-old black youth, if there's a black liberal female judge that doesn't believe in locking black males up for a few joints and sending them off to state prison, you know, under some small amount of pot or even a narcotic, but instead believes in rehab versus some white law and order judge, how smart do you have to be in terms of formal education to realize that it's better for your community not to send people away to jail at $35,000 a year, but instead try to rehab them within the community?
Right. And it's clear they're definitely qualified people who are able to represent their communities in Columbus, in the African-American community. So I think that suppressing the black vote does have a horrible detrimental effect on their communities, because there are definitely people who are very capable and willing to step up.
And a lot of this really goes back. I mean, people really need, I want to give you my in-the-nutshell history, which I give my students all the time. The two-minute warning there. Look, in 1966, two politicians are elected for the first time. Ronald Wilson Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush. They're elected anti-civil rights. They're states' rights. They believe in white supremacy, that each state should decide. Mm-mm-mm. Then in 1980, they're elected as a presidential team, Ronald Wilson Reagan. Where do they open their campaign? George Herbert Walker Bush, former CIA director, Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Ronald Reagan shows up at this place known for the Klan chapter and known historically where the bodies of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were buried for registering people to vote. And he shows up and says, "I believe in states' rights." And David Duke, the Klan member, says Reagan's speech sounds like it was written by a Klan member. Then you have the massive war on drugs targeting black people and tripling the amount of Americans in jail. It was a deliberate, racist, targeted effect to destroy the movements of the 1960s.
As said by Bob Fetrakis on Fight Back.
Right on, my brother. And sister.
On WCRS 98.3, 102.1.
This show is brought to you by the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism. Read the Free Press at www.freepress.com. www.columbusinstitute.org, a project of the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism.